Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. Baseball is America's pastime, and each fall we look forward to the climactic event of that sport, the World Series. In a moment, Talking History's Dennis Mihalik will take a look at the history of baseball and the World Series with his guest, baseball historian Benjamin Rader. But first, let's look back at an important event that occurred this week in history. During this week in 1781, British troops under Lord Charles Cornwallis surrendered to a combined American and French force at Yorktown, Virginia. It was the final major battle of the War for American Independence. After a series of reversals and the depletion of his forces, the British commander in the southern colonies moved his army from North Carolina to Yorktown, hoping to reestablish his seaborne lines of communication with the British army of General Henry Clinton in New York City. Instead, Cornwallis found himself trapped on a peninsula between land forces led by American Commander-in-Chief George Washington and a French fleet under the Comte de Grasse. Cornwallis was forced to surrender on October 19th. The casualties on both sides were light, but the total number of British prisoners was nearly 8,000. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, an 87-year-old British woman who passed along nuclear weapons secrets to the Soviets for more than four decades was unmasked recently as one of the most important spies ever recruited by the Soviet Union. Melita Norwood, a former secretary for a metals research group, whose work was critical in developing the British nuclear deterrent, acknowledged that she supplied information that probably enabled the Soviet Union to acquire the atomic bomb at least 2 years earlier than expected. Recently, Norwood told reporters, "I thought that perhaps some of what I had access to might be useful in helping Russia to keep abreast of Britain, America, and Germany." Paleoanthropologist Eric Delson certainly did not expect to discover a possible link in the evolution of humankind while walking the streets of New York City, but he did when he spotted a peculiar-looking skull in the window of Henry Galliano's natural history shop. Delson determined that the skull belonged to Homo erectus, who lived between 100,000 and 1 million years ago in its likely place of origin at the Solo River in central Java. You're listening to Talking History. If baseball's America's game, then the World Series, which is on everyone's mind these days, is America's foremost sporting event. And it's been that way for decades. Both have a fascinating history, and here to explain that history for us is Talking History's Dennis Mihalik and his special guest, baseball historian Benjamin Rader.
Thank you, Brian. It's World Series time again. The winner of the best of seven games will be declared this year's champion in the sport called the American pastime. Here to put baseball and the series in historic perspective is Benjamin Rader, professor of history at the University of Nebraska at Lincoln. Dr. Rader is the author of two books on athletics, American Sports, From the Age of Folk Games to the Age of Televised Sports, and Baseball, A History of American's Game. Welcome, Dr. Rader.
Thank you, Dennis.
Well, let's get right to it. I mean, what are the origins of the World Series?
We had a national championship series, sometimes called the World Championship Series, actually in the in the 1880s, a lot farther back than we usually think of the World Series starting. This was between the champion teams of the National League and the American Association. The American Association folded in 1891, so this series came to an end, and it had always been an informal kind of ad hoc affair. But in 1903, when the National League recognized the American League as a major league, a series began between the champions of the two leagues. It was actually discontinued in 1904, but it began again in 1905. So that beginning from 1905 up to the present, with one interruption, we've had a World Series every year since that time. In some sense, however, it's a misnomer because until recently, there were no teams outside the United States playing in the contest.
Yes, that's true. Now, I mean, baseball is described here in the United States as our national pastime, as America's game. Was it actually invented here?
Probably not. It's very difficult to know exactly the history, early history of the game. We certainly, I think it almost goes without saying that the game was not invented per se, at least certainly not by an individual. The English had the various kinds of boys' games played far back, probably back to the Middle Ages or perhaps even earlier. These games were brought to America in the colonial period in the 19th century, widely played by boys, not by men, usually. These games evolved into probably the modern game of baseball in the pre-Civil War period.
I see. And the basis of the game, I mean, did they play with a baseball and a stick or something?
Yes, it was played with a bat and a ball. Sometimes there were one base, sometimes two or three bases, depending upon the space and the situation. The baseball is perpetuated, of course, a myth that it was invented in the United States, and it was invented by Abner Doubleday in 1839 by this Civil War general hero. But in fact, the game evolved from this boys game.
Okay. And then what about the national pastime? Is it still the United States' number one sport?
I think not. Baseball has suffered a serious decline in terms of attendance, in terms of the number of teams, since about the 1950s. This decline can be measured in several different ways. One is in terms of the minor league structure. The minor league structure is much smaller than it was in the 1940s and early 1950s. The basic ground level of baseball has declined sharply. That is, up to the 1950s, you could find many semi-professional teams, small town teams, scattered all over the United States. You found children, boys in particular, but girls sometimes too, playing informal pickup games in empty lots and cow pastures across America up until the 1950s. This whole superstructure has essentially disappeared from baseball to present time. Major League Baseball, of course, is thriving. This commercial kind of baseball is thriving at present time, but overall, I think baseball is not as central to people's lives as it was in the 1950s. Probably football is more important, perhaps basketball too, to most Americans than is baseball.
Mm-hmm. Now, your response brings up a number of questions. Like, for example, I live in Omaha, that's home to a minor league team. When did this kind of city franchising of major and minor come about?
It evolved out of efforts by some leagues to establish themselves as the premier or the major league back in the 19th century. The process began as early as the 1876, I should say. It's kind of a turning point when the National League came into existence. There's a National League trying to establish itself as the Premier League and to call everybody else a minor league. The minor leagues have, throughout much of the history of baseball, however, have not cared for this designation. That is, they prefer also to be known as the major league. And the major leagues have more or less coerced them into this position by stealing their players from them, the better players. And the minors found eventually that it was in their interest to cooperate with the majors to protect their players from the majors raiding them by agreeing to become a minor league. The present structure we have dates back to 1903, or roughly 1903. It's had some modifications since then. So it's been in existence for a long time.
Now, what you're describing seems like business operations. When and why did baseball emerge as a big business?
Well, it's been a business, not perhaps a big business, since at least the 1870s, perhaps even earlier. In the 19th century, it remained a fairly small business enterprise, but it grew larger in the 20th century as baseball became a a larger enterprise. It really took off as a major commercial enterprise, perhaps even more recently than that, the television and the introduction of television in the 1950s into baseball, and then some exceptionally rich owners in the 1980s and 1990s have changed the economics of the industry considerably.
Mm-hmm. Now, in the economics of the industry, as you call it, in your book, Baseball, you argue that there was an old game of baseball that ended in the 1950s.
Mm-hmm.
What were the major characteristics of this old game, and why did it cease?
Well, related to the pride of honors is one characteristic of the old game, I think, and that is that many of the owners in the pre-1950s period were relatively rich. They were not nearly as rich as present-day owners. They may have made some money off of baseball itself. Many of them, in fact, had come up through the ranks of the players to become owners. They had frequently been small-time entrepreneurs, and they, for the most part, invested in baseball to make money from it, to enhance their personal fortunes, not as a means of gaining public visibility, which is often the reason that people invest in baseball today. Self-made men that are not obtaining the kind of recognition they think they deserve in the business world or elsewhere, they purchase a team as a way of increasing their visibility. The older game, too, was different in as much as prior to Jackie Robinson's breaking into baseball. Baseball, of course, had been a racially segregated sport since the 1880s. There had been a brief time that baseball had been integrated then. The game was played differently then. It was played on natural grass everywhere and in ballparks that had been built early in the century. These ballparks would soon be destroyed and replaced by more antiseptic kinds of ballparks. They played with floppy gloves. And then the pitchers usually went the distance, pitched the entire game, unlike today, which relief pitchers brought in much more frequently than in the past. The athletes were still not, they still resemble the typical male more than they do today. A typical baseball player today is much larger, much stronger than the average male. For example, it's kind of difficult to imagine a Ted Williams today hitting all those home runs.
Mm-hmm. What about the pay? I mean, like today, I think I saw mentioned that the average salary, which may not be the right statistic to use, but the average salary was over $1 million for a baseball player.
Yes. The big pay increases begin with the collapse of the reserve clause in baseball and free agency. This begins roughly in 1976, and since then, the old system tied a ballplayer to his team for his entire playing career unless he was traded or unless he was dismissed from his team, so that the franchise had him tied up virtually as a kind of slave, if you will. Mm-hmm. Through his entire playing career. But with the collapse of the reserve clause in 1976, then baseball negotiated a collective contract to call for free agency after they played so many years in the big leagues. At that point, players went on the open market and therefore could bid up their salaries. If the owners bid for them, their salaries could go up spectacularly as they have. They also have an arbitration procedure in baseball a mandatory arbitration procedure in baseball that places great pressure on salaries to increase salaries. So baseball, more than in fact any of the other major professional sports, has built into it a system that encourages salary expansion. And I would add furthermore that the owners, the baseball teams, as I pointed out earlier, are looking for visibility and are willing to bid up these salaries. That is, they don't practice any self-restraint with respect to salaries, so you get these huge salary disparities.
Mm-hmm. Now, you dubbed the era between World War I and World War II the age of dynasties.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that obviously had something to do with money, did it not?
Yes, it certainly did. The tendency was in those days in particular, but this has not changed totally even today, was for the teams located in the big cities with large numbers of potential spectators to monopolize talent. That is, they had the financial resources because they could command a large number of spectators corner the best talent in the game. That is, they could buy players from the poorer franchises or buy minor league players more effectively or trade for them with their vast financial resources. So that the New York Yankees, in particular, dominated baseball in the 20s, 30s, 40s, and through the 50s, up in the mid-60s. New York teams, what I think about, as I recall, about two-thirds of the championships in both leagues in this period, include Brooklyn and the New York Giants. So the teams in the big cities tended to dominate baseball. The St. Louis Cardinals were something of an exception here because of the very clever farm system developed by Branch Rickey.
Uh-huh. But now, speaking of those New York teams, I mean, this year, baseball lost one of its legends associated, of course, with the New York team, that is Joe DiMaggio. What's DiMaggio's significance to the game? I mean, why all the hoopla surrounding the individual 30, 40 years after he retired?
Yeah, he seems to hold a special place. I was, perhaps like you, surprised at the public reaction to his death. And I've tried to understand it. I think it is partly in terms of the times in which he was a star in baseball. This was in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s. Well, he retired by then in the early 50s. But this era was a period in American history in which Americans were searching for common heroes, people who could represent what they perhaps called at that time the American way of life, which included all ethnic or racial groups. There was a tendency toward the homogenization of American life during the post-World War II period in particular. And I think DiMaggio represented this impulse quite effectively. He was self-made. He came up from the wars of San Francisco as an Italian-American. And in that sense, he fulfilled the ideal of a self-made man, which is an important American ideal. And he of course, played with great dignity and elegance on the field, fulfilling the kind of images that Americans idealized. And today, perhaps many of those principles are absent. That is, our society today may be characterized by more strife and conflict than it was in the 1940s and 50s, or at least we may perceive it that way. Mm-hmm. And so there may be a nostalgia for the 1940s DiMaggio, what DiMaggio symbolized in the 1940s.
Uh-huh. Well, thank you. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have. I want to thank our guest, Dr. Benjamin Rader, professor of history at the University of Nebraska at Lincoln, and the author of Baseball, A History of America's Game.
Joe, what do you know?
We need a hit, so here I go.
Ball one. Ball two.
The World Series may be an exclusively male event, but women have played professional baseball as well. Here to tell you about the history of women in professional baseball is Gay Berlage, professor of sociology at Iona College in New Rochelle, New York. Berlage is the author of Women in Baseball, The Forgotten History, published in 1994 by Prager Press.
Most people think of baseball as a male sport and softball as the female equivalent. That women have played baseball since 1866 is a fact few Americans know. It wasn't until 1992, when the movie A League of Their Own was released, that most of the public became aware that women had ever played baseball. The movie gave a fictionalized account of the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League of World War II. Today, most people know about the AAGBL, and equate its existence with the manpower shortage caused by the war. This brief window of opportunity for women to play baseball is assumed to be an isolated event. Yet after the AAGBL folded in 1954, Bill Allington, one of the most successful coach managers in the AAGBL, formed a professional women's barnstorming team, Allington's All-Americans. This team, composed of former AAGBL players, toured the United States and Canada from 1955 to 1957, playing against men's teams. Way before the existence of the AAGBL, women played baseball. At the turn of the century, there were women professional ball players, umpires, and owners. Lizzie Arlington was a pitcher in 1898, Alta Weiss a pitcher from 1907 to 1922, Lizzie Murphy, a first basewoman from 1918 to 1935, Amanda Clement, an umpire from 1905 to 1911, and Helene Britton, the owner of the St. Louis Cardinals from 1908 through 1917. There were also numerous professional women's barnstorming teams, such as the Chicago Bloomer Girls, the New York Bloomer Girls, and the Boston Bloomer Girls, that toured the country playing men's semi-pro teams. To make the Bloomer Girls teams more competitive, some teams might have one or two male players, often as pitcher or shortstop. Two very successful major leaguers, Smokey Joe Wood and Rogers Hornsby, got their start playing Bloomer Girls baseball. Based on this early history of women's involvement in baseball, one would have expected that baseball would be a woman's sport as well as a men's. Today, the chances of a woman playing Major League Baseball are remote. The primary reason is that few girls play. Until the 1930s, there were girls who played baseball on the sandlot, on the playground, and in some colleges. Although softball was invented in 1887, it didn't become popular until the 1930s. In 1933, the Amateur Softball Association made the term softball official, and this name was substituted for the modified baseball games girls had been playing. Around that time, public and private schools and colleges that had been ordering baseball equipment for girls began to order softball equipment. Softball became identified as the women's game. In 1939, Little League Baseball was organized for boys only. Today, most parents encourage their sons to play baseball and their daughters to play softball. At the junior high, high school, and college levels, baseball is designated a boys' sport and softball a girls'. Although girls have been allowed to play Little League Baseball since 1974, most girls opt to play Little League Softball instead. Because of this, few girls have the opportunity to develop the skills necessary to be a major league player. Unless girls begin to participate in large numbers in Little League, high school, and college baseball, the chances of a woman playing in the major leagues will remain remote.
You've been listening to Gay Berlage, professor of sociology at Iona College and the author of Woman in Baseball, The Forgotten History. This is Talking History.
In the street, Jackie Robinson hit that ball. Kid went zooming across the left field wall. Hit a ball.
Yes, yes, Jackie hit that ball.
If you haven't already guessed what our site of the week is, we're going to tell you now. As they say, of the nation's best athletes, it's a natural. And here to tell you all about it is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
Located on Main Street in Cooperstown, New York, the National Baseball Hall of Fame and Museum is probably one of the best-known sports shrines in the world. There are lots of exhibits for everyone of all ages. From the centerpiece of the museum, the historic Hall of Fame gallery, where plaques of all 244 Hall of Fame members line the oak walls. The Great Home Run Chase exhibit features record-setting artifacts from Babe Ruth and Roger Maris, as well as Mark McGwire and Sammy Sosa. There are paintings and sculptures related to baseball. There's the Salute to Champs exhibit, which features the reigning World Series champs, and there are films covering the timeline of baseball, the newly refurbished ballparks exhibits, and much, much more. Well worth the trip for any baseball fan.
And finally, turning to our weekly segment, Coming Attractions, Halloween will soon be here, and just to be sure to give you plenty of notice on a number of interesting Halloween, or at least occult-related programs, we thought we would list them for you this week. On October 25th, the History Channel will premiere Exorcising the Devil, which examines the long history of exorcism in Christianity. On October 27th, the History Channel will air Hitler and the Occult, exploring Adolf Hitler's beliefs in the power of the occult. On October 28th, The Evil Eye, which, as the title suggests, is all about the history of voodoo. And on October 29th, a special presentation, The Haunted History of Halloween. All these should put you in the spirit for trick-or-treating and to listen to our special show next week on one of the most dramatic witchcraft trials in history, the trial of Urban Grandier. That's all we have for this week's show, and until next time, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions by email to talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. From the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.
So I say D, I say D-O, D-O-D, D-O-D-G, D-O-D-G-E-R-S, team, 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 O. I say O-M, O-M-A, O-M-A-L, O-M-A-L-L-E-Y, oh, really? No O'Malley. Sandy Koufax, oh, my Drysdale Moe.